This is Abraham Joff, director of Tales by Light and Big Cat Tales on Verbal Shenanigans.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
All right, what is up, everybody out there in the universe that is tuning in to this hot program, the hottest program in Pittsburgh, and the hottest program in Oregon, and the hottest program in Washington, D.C., not to mention New Jersey and Georgia. We are Verbal Shenanigans. Welcome on back. Mike Berlow, how are you?
I'm doing good, Scotty. I hate to inform you, we're doing cold in Guam. I looked at the numbers. We're not get the Guamians into our style of banter, if you will.
Is that what you call people from Guam? Guamians? Guamans?
That's what I'm going to start calling them. I don't care.
I don't care. I call you what I want.
Yeah. What are you? You're a property of the United States, so you listen to me, a U.S. citizen. Listen up, Guamians. You better start listening to Verbal Shenanigans. Or else we're going to have to go over there and take care of some business.
Yeah. Mike Berlow, the fire marshal, calls whatever you want, whatever he wants to do. That's what he calls you. He doesn't care.
Nope.
He doesn't care about your race, your gender, your nationality. He just makes things up for you, and that's officially what you are.
Listen, I'm sick and tired of listening to people. It's about time that God complex started really like bubbling up inside, and. It's time to take care of business. You're going to enjoy the universe under Berlew control, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, joy.
Well, at least we'll start with Guam, and then we'll work our way to the universe.
So you think Guam is a good starting point to start your game, your real life game of Risk?
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think. I can't fathom how many people are in Guam to begin with. I mean, granted, for what I understand, there's a military base down there. So, but other than that, I don't think there's a major threat with Guam. So,
you're saying that you're bold enough and strong enough to just enter Guam and take over with no resistance?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to have to put it on MapQuest to figure out where they're at. But I mean, once that's done, I mean, it's pretty much I'll write my own script and it'll come out the way I like it.
So, big white man goes down to Guam automatically. You just take over.
Yeah, I mean, I've read a couple of history books. It's happened a couple of times. I can't see. It hasn't happened in a while, which is concerning me. But
when was it? I mean, those of you who are just tuning in, you know, I like to host the show, but I also like to bring brains on board the show to kind of back me up because I don't know everything. You know, part of being a good host is not knowing everything. So, Mike. But pretty much how he entered the show was one day, you're like, yeah, you know, I don't know everything. I really need to reach out to the brains of the operation.
True.
So don't let his accent fool you. He is actually a genius. Berlow,
I didn't know my accent took away my genius there. Wait a minute. What happened there?
Let's not get into it. But, I mean, tell us, Berlow. I mean, most of the listeners probably don't know. When was the last time there was a Guam takeover by the white man?
I think it was around 1839, if I recall.
1839.
Yeah. Okay. This was pre-airplanes and stuff, so we had to, and we were kind of in the Depression, I think, around that time, so we didn't have, like, the high-class stuff to take over the country, so we had to use some of the old wooden boats that we used to get over to America in the first place, like the
right.
Santa Maria and those other couple ones.
Oh, good.
I think we use those.
I like how you just pulled out the one boat name, the one old boat name that you know.
Well, that was the key one. I mean, nobody else cares about the other two. Right. I mean, come on.
Right.
Like, even Columbus was like, you know, why am I on this boat, man? I want to be over there with the Santa Maria. Those guys are cool.
So the Santa Maria ends, I don't know if that's correct, Berlow, you would know. They were the cool boat. Not the Nina or the
absolutely.
Not the Nina or the Pinta.
Every night there was a party on there. I mean, they had like the accountants on the Pinta.
Right.
And they had a bunch of like rejects on the other one. It, uh-huh. Like they had a radio contest, and a bunch of people got on that first
right.
boat.
Naturally,
and, you know, it wasn't people you want to hang around with. You know, they were the fakers. But the Santa Maria, I mean, oh my God, the stories I've been told from that boat, I'm all just absolutely epic. The keggers that gone on
now,
to the New World.
Interesting. That was a long time ago, at least according to history books. Who's telling you these stories about the Santa Maria?
Well, I mean, I dig around. I look at ancient transcripts. There's a lot of old papers that are around, and I just read them, and I just naturally assume they're historical and truthful. So I just go
you spend
with
your days in your basement surrounded by natural papers, as you call them, around, historical papers just lying around, and you're just picking them up and reading them.
Yeah, I mean, what I do once in a while, I'll go out to, like, a local park, and I'll just start grabbing loose papers that I see on the ground, and I can only assume it's lost history, and I just gather it up, and I bring it home, and I start reading it, and I just say, okay, now I know history.
Right, right. So, Berlo, now I know what Guam translates to, but what does Guam actually mean?
Gum. It's Spanish for gum. It's
so they just took a
syllable.
They
were very
out.
Known for their, you know, that's where they invented like back in those days. A lot of people were into like licorice, which it wasn't flavored. It's
they
not
were
like the Twizzlers
licorice.
Of these days.
Okay,
but that little tiny island was the historical point where gum came to be, and that's it was such a big hit, and it was traded throughout the world. That's why they just named the country Spanish gum or Guam.
So you're just saying over time it just kind of translated to gum, but it used to be like, oh, I got this pack of chewing gum. Like, oh, blow bubbles mm-hmm. of the chewing gum.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, the natives were just known for that. Like when ships were coming to dock and all, they would look in their little telescope thing and they'd be like, what's going on? These natives, they look weird. They have these like pink bubbles in front of their mouth, and they get confused and scared, and sometimes it drives away the enemies, if you will. That's why the Guam takeover didn't work the first time. People weren't knowledgeable of what they had there.
So like those monkeys who have that inflatable thing like in their throat, and like frogs and stuff like that to make themselves seem bigger, they used to blow bubbles to kind of reinforce that, like to scare people off.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Now it's weird,
it's
because
nature's way of scaring off enemies.
Now you know so much about Guam. I just looked up some things. It to me, I don't know why here it says on the website that Guam means Island of the Warriors.
No. That was their local basketball team. They were the Gum Warriors.
Oh, the Gum Warriors. Interesting.
Yes.
Interesting.
Yes, that was their local team. You know, they'd have a mascot who'd come running around blowing bubbles to the crowds. It was hilarious and amazing and all. They didn't last too long. apparently, basketball did not take off in Guam for some reason.
Now, real quick before we wrap up our Guam talk, who – I forgot. I had to look this up, but who discovered Guam?
David Bubblicious.
David Bubblicious. How come he's not in history books, though, David Bubblicious?
He was a very humble man. You know, he just felt that just because he found the country, he didn't want to be known as the country. He later paid tribute by making the Bubblicious plants and all that wonderful bubble gum, but he didn't want everybody to just sit back and consider him the founder. He knew the locals. He played basketball with them as the Warriors, but he did not want to be solely the Christopher Columbus of Guam.
Interesting. So this fact that I'm reading that Ferdinand Magellan discovered Guam is completely false.
Yes. Magellan, he was an a-hole. I got to be honest with you.
Really?
He was a guy who just loved spreading rumors because, you know, they didn't have the historical papers like I do.
Huh.
And he would just be going around. He'd be making up stuff, you know. He once said he made the cotton mill.
No guy. Way.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah, he's a very braggadocious person, but you know, he just sat back and prayed that people didn't look up stuff. And once in a while, somebody's like, hey, wait a minute. And then he would have to leave town because everybody knew his secret. Then he would just move to the next city and make up stories about something else that he did.
Well, Berlin, you never cease to amaze me with your world knowledge. It's just that you become such an asset on this show. Like, I mean, you don't bring anything else to the show, but your knowledge...
Absolutely not.
Your knowledge is just incredible.
Well, you know, Scott, when you have a duty to this world, you have to provide it, and you can't hold back because the world needs the power of knowledge.
Right.
And that's the key to living a good
life.
It's
just how important history is. It's amazing. Maybe we should hook you up with those American Loser guys we know that run that podcast. You might be really effective on that. So,
yeah, KP doesn't return my phone calls for some reason. It's very odd. I think it has something to do with his father. I think his father doesn't like me, even though we never met. Maybe he's upset about I have too much knowledge, and maybe I'll take his
role,
co-host.
His
seat.
Role. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Berlo. Thank you for that. Guys... Anyway, those of you who are still tuning in who haven't killed yourself in the first the first 6 minutes of the show, welcome. Welcome to Verbal Shenanigans. What's shocking, folks, is that this was actually our second opening to the show because we lost such comedy gold and such entertainment gold on the first one due to a malfunction with the recorder. So you guys are being treated to this second dose of audio goodness that we like to call Verbal Shenanigans. So in a roundabout way, welcome to the show.
Yeah, the sequel definitely went better than the original, but I still like the opening we did in the original, Scott.
All right, Berlo. You know, like, I mean, you earned yourself a token, okay? You earned yourself a token with your intro, I mean, with your Guam knowledge that you brought to the show. I think you get a shot to do the intro. And as you guys know, my least favorite part of the show is to do the intro. I never know what to say. Never know what to say. Do I say, hey, what's up? Do I have a weird catchphrase? I already got a crappy catchphrase at the end of the podcast. Do I bookend, you know, the podcast with catchphrases? I don't want to be the hacky guy. So I'm always like, hey, what's up? And I kind of let the music run in and always say hello and try to figure out a different way. Never know a different way. It's kind of always the same. In fact, every time I go to edit the podcast, I'm like, oh, every single time you're doing that, huh? I go, hey, hello, how you doing out there?
Yeah.
So
it's episode 2 something or other.
Right. So Berlo, episode 243, here we go. Pretend the music is playing right now. You know what? In post-production, I'll put the music in right now. Go. And our shenanigans are tricky and fun. And his shenanigans are funny. The next guy says shenanigans, pistol whip.
Oh, you're doing the intro. I was wondering what the hell you were doing.
Oh, yeah. That's my interpretation of the intro.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to episode 243 of Verbal Shenanigans.
Oh.
It's time to start your engines.
He's got a prop.
You're in for an hour of comic gold and interesting interviews if you don't mind us tooting our own horn. I'm your co-host, Michael Berlew, and here is your host of the show, the one and the only, Scott Brennan. Okay, go.
The fact that I had to sit through that a second time, there is not a gun close enough to me that could end this. Wow.
On a side note, while we were finding out we didn't have it recorded and you were getting things fixed up, I was hitting the buttons at random just to take him off.
He was. No one was recording, and I just hear yee-haw in the background over and over and over again. Berlo, so in comedy, a lot of people look down on prop comics. I can't even imagine what a prop radio host is. You're holding up it's the General Lee. It is a toy car of the General Lee.
Yes. Basically, when I went down to the parents for the Easter holiday, my dad said he got something for me at a yard sale. And lo and behold, my happy Easter became the prized possession of the General Lee, with sound effects, mind you.
So he was like, "Ah, you know what my 40-something-year-old son needs? This used this used toy that makes noises from a show in the 70s and 80s.
Absolutely, man. I got it lined up with my diecasts here. I got it in the front of the line. It's a lead car. It's in the lead. I put, if I had a Roscoe P. Coltrane car, I put him dead last because that's what happens on the Deuce. He never gets a break. He never catches them Duke boys.
This is going to be probably our, you know what karma's going to be? Karma's going to be like, this is the most downloaded episode like we've ever had.
Yeah, we broke 10,000. There's Scott, so many questions on the internet right now.
Scott, this Podcoin app really works. We got a bazillion emails. We got fans. All our t-shirts are bought. This is amazing. They're all chanting, do another intro, bring a new toy car in next week.
I'll bring in Daisy's Jeep next week.
Now, those of you who've lasted this long into the show, Mike has an extensive amount of knowledge to the old show, The Dukes of Hazzard. So much so that if there was like a Jeopardy version of it, I would put money that Berlew could last. He could hang with some big time like TV trivia nerds, and they're big nerds out there for sure that are totally into that stuff. But he knows every weird character. When Berlew was moving away, amazingly timing wise, I was able to round up John Snyder, who was Bo Duke, as a kind of a surprise guest for Mike. So this Dukes of Hazzard theme has kind of gone on for a long time, and now he's got toys. So the transition to just a big little kid is happening, Berlew.
Yeah, it's working out well. I mean, can't be in a better state to have that General Lee hanging high than here. So, I mean, it's good to be alive, Scotty. I'm in the General's neighborhood, if you will.
Oh, good. Because after this podcast, I might no longer be alive.
I finally got it. The show is mine. I told you, Guamians, I got control.
Welcome to episode 278. Yeehaw!
I figure I'd change things up. I did the yeehaw first before the engine rev. You know what I mean? You can't do the same thing over and over and think people are going to be satisfied with
right,
Scott.
Right. I don't know. I'm glad that you got your toy from your dad and fulfilled your Easter dreams. Easter, a holiday that, as we were talking before the show, no one really gets up for Easter. No one's really fired up to celebrate Easter. Even as a kid, Easter was never like, yeah, I can't wait for Easter. Just like, okay, I guess we have to get together. Who's cooking?
Yeah, it's the kind of a throwaway. And like we were talking about, people get excited for Christmas, New Year's, Thanksgiving, 4th of July.
I get pumped for Arbor Day.
I mean, Memorial Day, people get excited for picnics, even Labor Day. Women get excited for Valentine's Day. There's no real oomph around Easter, if you will. I mean, because if you think about it, majority of people don't get a day off because of it.
Right.
Most of the time, people forget when it is until it's, like, coming up. But basically, people remember when it's like, oh, crap, I can't eat meat today on Friday. So I guess Easter's coming up.
I think because Easter is so disjointed, it's everywhere. It's all over the map. It involves zombie Jesus. It involves religion. It involves somehow bunnies, chocolate, eggs. Like, bunnies don't lay eggs, but yet they hide them. It's just a very confusing holiday that really, I feel like they just gave up. They're just like, yeah, we're just going to go with something. Let's let this guy Al, the stoner, figure it all out. We'll just write it in or something. Like, they phoned it in.
I think they did like a Mad Libs and they just filled in it. All right, I need our noun. Yeah. Okay, bunny. And then
chocolate eggs.
He's coming from death. Okay, that's interesting.
Wow. We went from Jesus to bunnies. Interesting. I might have told you on the podcast. Did I ever tell you my story about my rabbit?
I somewhat remember it, but I'm sure our audience may be interested in the story again.
So when I was a kid, I was never allowed to have a dog or a cat or anything like that. But we went to this kind of like a garage sale of a friend of ours, and they had like a bunch of bunnies. This is how dumb I am. I just almost said puppy bunnies. I meant to say baby bunnies.
I just had the vision of like a bunny with Obi's head right now, and you just like infatuated with it. No,
yeah, yeah. So I convinced my mom to get the bunny. It's a black rabbit, and his name was Scooter. I named him Scooter, and I liked Scooter. He was a cool rabbit, and at the time we had a screened-in patio. So we had the cage in there, but we kept the patio closed, and he was able to kind of just like hop around at his leisure whenever he wanted, you know, like, cause that was pretty cool. He lived a pretty good life. Now he was a little screwy. He would run full speed in circles and just jolt himself into the wall occasionally, which was pretty interesting. And he would kind of like head shake, like after he ran into the wall, he would also do this weird thing where we'd roll him a kickball, like this little kickball he had. It was like a toy. And he would just start, like, humping the kickball. Very, very strange behavior.
Was it a male bunny?
It was a male bunny. Let me say this as PC as I can. He had very large male parts for a bunny.
I mean,
he was a black rabbit.
Like, how many bunnies did you look at to compare to come up with that synopsis?
That's true. I guess I really didn't have much to compare it to. Okay, yeah. So
don't be going about your bunny's junk.
Right. It could.
You don't know. You don't know.
I guess it just stood out. Like, wow, that's bigger than I would expect a rabbit to have. I guess. And this bunny was interesting. I tried to be like the best bunny owner early on. Like, I even went to as far as getting a bunny leash, thinking that I was going to walk this rabbit around somehow, right? You know, like
you're gonna go for a jog in the woods with your bunny,
right?
Was your plan,
right? Okay, like, you know, we'll do hiking. We'll just be best friends forever. Me and the bunny.
Yeah, I haven't heard about bunny mountain climbers. No. So, I mean, you would have been the first if you tried it.
So I remember taking the bunny. I tried to put him on the leash at the park, which was across the street from my house growing up, and go to walk the bunny, and the leash gets caught around his leg, and all of a sudden I just hear like these crazy noises. Now I remember being at first, I didn't even know it was the rabbit, because I never knew rabbits made noise.
I was about to say, do they naturally make any sounds during the day, or is that literally like the first
I had ever heard, and literally like kind of like this screaming sound, like, like, I was like, oh my God, oh my God. I was all like panicked and tried to get the leash off his leg and stuff. And that was the last of the leash. Now, so I had the bunny a couple years, okay? And the bunny, he's cool, man. Like, my grandma kind of like half lived with us, so she would take care of it a lot. Like, he had a tray. And rabbits pee like really smells, man. And they like poop like a million times a day. It's just a little pellets, basically.
Pellets.
So you get
that's why I'm a little surprised your parents, if they were anti dog and cat, would go to a bunny. It's kind of like a ferret. Like before I got my dog way back when I was just single, I was thinking about getting a ferret, but they both of them just like stink like hell in their natural habitat.
Yeah. Well, I guess maybe because this was an outside animal, maybe they were more apt to it. I don't know.
All right.
Now, my mom never liked the rabbit. Never liked it. She thought she had to take care of it. And I was young. I was in, like, middle school and, like, you know, out all the time. And so my mom never liked the rabbit. So the day comes. It's a July day. I'm working. Now I'm probably in, like, maybe 9th or 10th grade or something like that. And I'm working at the pool. And it's a July day. And it's probably 100 degrees outside. And this happened to be the day that my parents were getting new aluminum siding on the house. Now, before that, we had like cedar shakes, like, you know, like wood shakes, and the rabbit chewed on them. And my mom hated the fact that the rabbit chewed on them. Drove her crazy. So there was like nibble marks all along the thing.
Now, so your parents spent thousands of dollars because of a bunny.
Well, no. I think they were just kind of trying to update the house in general, right? And my mom, you know, hated it to begin with. So I come home on this July day from work, and I'm like, where's Scooter? And they're like, oh, there's something we got to tell you. Scooter died. I'm like, oh, man. You know, like, upset a little bit. Like, oh, what happened? Like, I don't know. He was out in the backyard, and he started acting weird, and he just wasn't moving anymore. Oh, okay. I'm like, you know, first reaction, like, oh, maybe he died, you know, like natural. Then I'm thinking, starting to put the pieces together. Okay, one, he's a black rabbit. It's the middle of July. It's 100 degrees. Okay. Two, he's in an area with no shade. Okay. Three, my mom was getting new siding on the house. Always hated the rabbit for chewing on her old siding, spending a lot of money to put new siding on the house. You're telling me that they didn't barbecue this rabbit? I don't know. It's been a long time. Like I still bring it up. We call it like Rabbit Gate in the Brennan family.
Yeah, now I think they had a movie like that. It was called Fatal Attraction. Like, if you looked at the boiling pot that summer and all, what are you making, Mom? Corn?
Right.
Something like that, dear.
Yeah, it like turned out that my dad like even didn't know what to do with the rabbit, so they like put him in like a plastic bag and threw him in the dumpster by the Chinese restaurant down the street.
Not even a proper burial.
No, right? No ceremony. No, like, hey, anybody want to say a few words about Scooter Nash? Yeah, throw him with the old General Tso's.
It's too hot. There's no time for words. Throw him in the dumpster.
So all this time, I'm just thinking, my mom, they barbecued. They put him out in the sun and. Yeah, you know, he dead, so very touchy subject to this day. And my rabbit, you know, I think he may have suffered a hard death.
What was your rabbit's name?
Scooter. Scooter.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Scooter. I guess that Scooter's not going to rev up anymore.
No, ba-doom. So, yeah, so now I honestly think they tried to kill the rabbit? No way. No, they're not. Cruel, but it's very funny that all this kind of lined up to this conspiracy theory in the Brennan house.
I just imagine a scene where like they're looking over at the rabbit and it's like panting and in the sun and the wheels are just going in their heads. Okay, I can bring him in and give it a nice cold drink.
He's almost
but
there.
This aluminum siding I really like.
Yeah.
He'll get another animal one day.
All right. So with that, that was the end of my rabbit. But I guess that segues real naturally into our guest. our guest has a really interesting story. Now, months ago, I turned on Netflix and watched this documentary called Tales by Light. And it follows these photographers, a lot of them wildlife photographers, and some follow like indigenous people and stuff like that. And he's the director of this, and his name is Abraham Joffe. Now, Abraham has been out there filming whales and bears and you name it. He's done all sorts of work all around the world. So I'm pretty excited to talk to him. And he's got a hit series. He's also done, I think it's called Big Cats on Animal Planet. So a lot to talk about, Mike. So let's get Abraham on the line here.
Let's buzz him.
First off, Abraham, I want to thank you just for linking up with us. And we kind of been talking for months at this point, trying to set something up. And you've been in Kenya, you've been all over the world, and you not to mention you are, I don't know, 5-6 hours ahead of us. So it's been hard, but I want to thank you for finally lining up a time here. We appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure, and thanks for being patient to connect. It can be tricky with the amount of travel and time zones, I'm still not really, I should be better at organizing time zones than I am, seeing I'm always dealing with other countries. But yeah, pleasure to have a chat.
It's awesome, man. Now, like last week you said that you were going away to Kenya for 10 days. Now, I know you've shot a bunch of things in Kenya before, and you're kind of all over the place, even just following your Instagram and whatnot, just seeing what you're up to. You're in cold climates, warm climates, all over the place. But what were you doing in Kenya this time?
Well, we've been, I guess, through a couple of different series. We've had quite a bit to do in Kenya, mostly the Maasai Mara. We've been shooting a series, which is now on Animal Planet, called Big Cat Tales. And it was it stars Jonathan and Angela Scott, who are sort of renowned naturalists, photographers. I met them during Tales by Light Series 2 back in 2016 and just worked with them enormously. And we decided we enjoyed working with each other, and they're sort of they're known as the Big Cat people. And we decided to create a new series on the Big Cats with their 40 years of experience in the Maasai Mara. It was, you know, you'd be very hard pressed to find people who are so knowledgeable or as knowledgeable as Jonathan and Angie. And so, yeah, we actually self-produced a series following the lives of the leopards, lions, and cheetahs, and got it in front of Animal Planet, which is a little bit unorthodox to actually go and shoot a series before having a broadcaster or a deal in place. But we just believed in it so much that we decided to go ahead. And thankfully, Animal Planet were thrilled and actually launched it just a few months ago.
Yeah.
So, across their global.
I actually watched an episode of it the other night. So I guess kind of go backwards a little bit. The way I found about you was through your series Tales by Light, which I caught on Netflix, and it sucked me in. I watched, you know, I blew through the first season in, you know, 2 days or whatnot, and I loved it. Now I wanted to ask you, as a filmmaker, the challenge, for those of you who don't know Tales by Light, it focuses on photography, photographers, all these skilled photographers all over the world, and whether it's nature, whether it's people. How big of a challenge is that to, you know, you're taking an art that is focused on the still image, but making a documentary that is focused on moving image and telling a story? How hard was it to combine those two?
Yeah, it is tricky. I mean, it is, and it continues to be tricky because I think photography, as much as it lives online for many of us, I mean, we probably absorb 99% of all images now through digital means, not through the printed form.
Right.
The big challenge is trying to, I guess, cinematography and you know, as a filmmaker, cinematographer myself, we're always chasing the big, powerful moving images. It can be tricky to sort of do justice to the photography because I think it's competing in a medium which is obviously motion. So when you stick, you know, as great as an amazing photograph might be and a powerful image might be, you know, it's hard to, I guess, have it compete against the moving images. So I think it's really, we've really focused in on the story and the mission behind the photography, the motivations of the photographers, and try to, and as the series have developed, I think we've gotten better at exploring the stories of the subjects, whether they're nature, wildlife, conservation, human stories. We've sort of really focused in on the subjects that the photographers are following. So, but I think sadly, a lot of these images would be best served if they were to be seen, you know, in print, in a frame, or in a book. But we do our best to try to, you know, to serve them, do justice in the series.
Awesome. I can't tell if I hear Mike or not. I don't know if he dropped out of the corner. Mike, you there? There you are, Mike.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. I don't know. You're muted or something for a second. Go ahead.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, you know, I mean, when you're dealing with other photographers and they're going through their motions on getting these different pictures and shots, is this like an easy rapport talking with them with this idea where you're like, I want to see how you come up with your visions, or some of them kind of like close up where it's like, I don't want other people to know my ideas where they might steal my ideas?
Well, I guess with a series like this, we have an incredible amount of freedom to sort of to research and choose the people that we want to work with. So I guess I've been naturally drawn to people who are working in fields that I'm also interested in. And of course, there's a bit of a vetting process, and you've got to find people who not only are, you know, obviously brilliant at what they do as photographers, but they need to be able to communicate that to an audience, be comfortable on camera, and be the type of person that's happy to share. So there's quite a few little boxes to tick to get through to decide on a person to feature. And through that process, and a lot of, you know, once you meet people and we're working, and I've got quite a large network of filmmakers and photographers that I know that, you know, the same names do keep coming up, and you can do your research quite easily, and a lot of word of mouth. And we've been really lucky. I mean, everyone we've worked with has been fantastic to date, I think, because we've taken the time to decide. And yeah, I mean, we are spoiled for choice. There are a lot of great people out there, you know, in such a huge number of pursuits. And that's what I think filmmaking, photography, and I've always thought journalism, writing, they share a common thread that, you know, you can have a love for your craft, but then also, focus in on a genre that interests you. So, you know, if you're a photographer, you can almost photograph anything. I mean, there's car photographers, there's sports, underwater photographers, people who specialize in aerial photography. So almost any aspect of life, there are people who are focused and specialized in that area. So it's a great sort of platform for us to explore the world, really. That's what the show is about.
Now, I'm assuming as, you're director on a lot of these / cinematographer, I get when it comes to nature videos and documentaries, there's no action and cut, you know, as far as capturing these things. When you become a director of a nature based documentary like The Cats or Underwater, are you kind of more wearing, you know, all different hats because you're not only capturing images, but you have other guys working for you? How does that work being the director of something like that rather than, shooting a sketch or shooting a show within a studio? What are the differences being the director at that point?
Yeah, well, I mean, you're definitely right in terms of wearing lots of hats. In fact, everyone in the crew, and we work with very small crews, everyone wears a few hats because of the nature of the work. We need to stay in small teams. We almost all shoot underwater. We shoot aerials with drones. We run audio. We run the land topside cameras. So that's really important just from a practical sense that we can travel as a small team. When it comes to nature, yeah, it's certainly a completely different environment than sort of more structured productions. It all begins though before you head out. So, you know, if we are looking at a particular natural phenomenon, a migration or an animal behavior, almost always these things are seasonal. So there's going to be the best time of year to go
right
to try to capture the subject you're after. And that's obviously a lot of this collaboration is with the photographer themselves. If they've had experience in that area or it may be new to them. I mean, I do love taking photographers that we've featured to places they've never been because they don't need to fake the excitement, you know, going to a new destination or somewhere that you've always wanted to go. It's been on the list. Is brilliant. But sometimes we'll return to places where they have done a lot of their work, especially if it's sort of inherent to who they are. For example, Darren Dew, the underwater photographer, he is like 15 seasons with a humpback whale. So we have to do the humpbacks as part of his story. It's a big part of who he is as a photographer. So a lot of that information and that local knowledge can come from the photographer. And if we have to research, then, you know, we're talking to experts, fixers on the ground, trackers or spotters. In the Masai Mara, we work with a network of local spotters and guides that will feed us information back daily on the whereabouts of the different cat species. If we're going to an underwater destination, again, you'll have dive operators, people who work with the animals. So you sort of you're picking the season, you're picking the experts, the guides that are going to assist you, which is incredibly important. And then you do everything, you know, everything you can, right? And sometimes it's not going to happen. You know, we have gone on shoots where we just haven't managed to capture the subject. I think also that because this particular series is very much about the journey of the photographer,
right?
If there's failures, well, then you shoot the failures. You know, we're not shooting blue chip natural history content like a Planet Earth or a Blue Planet, where it is all about the subject. And if you don't get the subject, well, then they don't have a story. For us, sometimes the lack of the subject can be part of the story. For example, we went to the Himalayas. We went to Ladakh in northern India with Richard Ianson in the first series, and spent about a week for him. You know, he sort of dreamed to photograph snow leopard, to see, first of all, to see a snow leopard and hopefully photograph one. And we were actually quite lucky to see one at a kilometre or so away, but he didn't get a photograph. But it was still an interesting little part of his story. And then we sort of went on a big cat, which was the tigers in Bandavgarh. And then he had some incredible encounters there. So, yeah, I think the style of show does help us a little bit. I think I have a huge amount of respect for your blue chip natural history filmmakers who do need to spend weeks, months, years.
Right.
On. But usually those things, and I guess the closest we've come to experience that is the Big Cat Tales series, where we really needed the behaviour in the field, and we've spent, yeah, a cumulative many months in the Maasai Mara now. But it usually just comes down to time and patience. People watch the only, I guess, the downside, if you want to think about it, for these shows, is it can sometimes give a little bit of a unrealistic expectation to someone if they want to go to the Maasai Mara. I mean, it's an amazing place, and anyone who's lucky enough to go will have an incredible time. But people sometimes go to these places expecting to see a cheetah hunt or a mating, or, you know, because so much of it. But it can take weeks to see these things. So yeah, it's like it's being there and being there for a long enough period of time, generally.
Now, dealing with these wild animals enough times, are you at a level where you are comfortable with being around them, or is there still just a natural fear and caution when you're doing these trips?
I grew up sort of traveling around Australia, had an incredible childhood, surrounded by wildlife, catching lizards and snakes and diving all around Australia and snorkeling. You know, I had close encounters with crocodiles. Like, sort of that was my childhood, so I've always been very comfortable around wildlife. But you definitely have a respect and a, you know, that keeps you alive. I've also got a young family now, so I don't want to take unnecessary risks. But, you know, again, it's usually just being, having people who really know the creatures, having the experts with you is the best thing. And they'll always guide you on where to be, the safest place to be. I guess the underwater world, being in the ocean, is you probably feel the most vulnerable. There's almost no risk when we're filming the big cats, touch wood, because we're filming out of vehicles. And as long as you don't get out of the vehicle, then you're fine. The ocean is where you fully immerse yourself in their environment. And but it's also something I love to do, so, you know, I'll continue to keep doing it.
Now you mentioned, you kind of segue naturally into my next question. Now, I know, just following your Instagram, that you just had a baby recently, which, so congratulations. And so how does that change? You know, you're a guy who makes, obviously, films that take long time to produce and you travel all over the world. How do you balance the life of doing these kind of immersive projects that, you know, that take time and patience and travel and everything, and balancing family life with this kind of work?
Well, it's a good question, very important one, and one I'm still working out. I've got an amazingly supportive wife who's been, you know, even before our son was born, was very supportive, and in fact has done quite a bit of travel with me when we were just the two of us on shoots, which was fantastic. It's really just planning. Not only do we have film opportunities, but I have opportunities to join lots of expeditions and trips and sometimes exploratory trips to look at new destinations. If I was a bachelor right now, I could probably be on the road every day of the year.
Right.
but I, you know, I want to be a dad, a good dad. You know, I want to be at home, and any day away from the family now is there is a you're sacrificing time, especially with a young child. So, yeah, it's really now for me is deciding which shoots really need me there. Starting to delegate a little bit more. I've got a great team around me, and just trying to limit the length of the trips. And if I go away, I've actually now, if I am home, I try to spend as much time as I possibly can, you know, at home with the family in between trips. So I feel like if I do it right, I can probably spend more time with the family than a lot of people who work 9 to 5 and maybe only see their kids on the weekends. So getting priorities straight and you know, I think it's a work in progress. Any parent can tell you.
Reading up on you when you were talking about your photography, you talk about how you play the odds and you give yourself the best possible chances, and there's a lot of luck factor into it. Has there been a story where you were just like 1 second away or something, where it just like, oh, that would have been the most perfect thing ever, and you just missed it?
Oh, you're making me bring back bad memories. We hate about the...
He does that. He does that.
That's what our show does. People think we like to talk to you. We just want to shove things in your face, you know?
Yeah. Oh, of course. I mean, I think it's totally natural to feel, I mean, really devastated by missing things, especially if they are, and often they are, they're something you may be lucky enough to see once in your lifetime, and that can be really, really hard to swallow. I've also been around other people, photographers, filmmakers, who've maybe missed something that was a once-in-a-lifetime moment, not only to capture it, but even to witness it. There's a great sense of loss. And, I've got numerous occasions where that's happened. I think, though, as the years have gone on, I've sort of started to be more philosophical about it. And one thing I take away is that, look, I'm very fortunate to keep traveling back into these amazingly wild places. And so if you do miss something, I am going to return to a lot of these places again. So, for example, I was devastated when I missed a huge wildebeest crossing in the Masai Mara in 2014 when I was filming there with Art Wolf. And it was a major crossing, and we decided to stop for lunch somewhere, and we should have kept going. We should have just stayed by the river. And there was tens of thousands of wildebeest that crossed, and it would have been a fantastic addition to the project we were working on. And I just felt so gutted I could cry. Maybe I did actually cry. I was, so upset about that event, and we were only there for a few days. But I think, as I said before, I think I've learned that I'm fortunate enough to return to these places. Luckily, data loss is something we've had very little of, but there's been a couple of things we've lost over the years that just human error will come into it. As much as you back up and triple back up and all those things, it can happen. That's maybe almost more devastating to have something shot and then have it lost.
Absolutely.
But then there's been so many things that we've been witnessed that are just incredible. And, I mean, for example, in shooting in the Masai Mara again in 2016, there was lots of amazing moments. One particular one for me was I spent 9 days in a row from sunrise to sunset with this cheetah, Malaika. And she was a real star cheetah of the Mara. Had a couple of young cubs, and we'd been trying to film her hunt, and she'd had quite a few unsuccessful hunts day after day. So, 9 days in, and on the ninth day, in the middle of the day, middle of the heat, she just had a massive sprint at a big male impala, and she came barreling down straight at us, like straight down the lens from a couple of hundred meters away. And anyone who's spent time with cheetah, you'll know how, first of all, how lucky you have to be there at the right moment to see a hunt, to see a successful hunt. But for her to run straight at the camera and for me to be able to shoot her straight on, and then the whole battle, and it was actually turned out to be a real battle, which was really unusual. A lot of cheetah hunts are over pretty quickly, but this is a big male impala. The horns went around her, and then they went on this dance, like almost like two animals locked horns, but this cheetah and the male impala, and it was a 7-minute battle in real time that we filmed.
Wow.
And our guide, Jackson Lusaya, he spent his whole life in the Mara, and he's 30 years guiding, and he said it was the most amazing hunt that he'd ever witnessed, which is, pretty amazing to think about all the thousands of days that he spent out there in the wild. So also filming glaciers last year, we filmed some incredible glaciers collapsing in Greenland. It was a devastating thing to witness. But there was some huge carvings that we captured with drones that was really very special, and that project, you know, will be coming out fairly soon. I can talk about more later, but, you know, we were very, very fortunate to sort of be in the right place at the right time. So I try to focus on the things that you do capture and just, you know, makes you appreciate them a bit more and try not to think too much about the losses.
Now, I assume all these, all your projects and things like that have to be like, you know, your babies and whatnot. You know, you're proud of all of them. Is there a particular animal or a particular experience that you are most proud of, or a particular animal that you prefer to follow or are fascinated more by than anything else, or is it all just kind of encompassed into work itself?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think that's probably a question a lot of photographers get, you know, what's your favorite location or country or species? I'm very fortunate, as I said before, to shoot across so many genres and not specialize too much. Gives an incredible variety. I mean, the big cats obviously are amazing to film in the ocean. I mean, spending time with tiger sharks, the shoot that we did in the Bahamas was absolutely incredible. And then we also went on with that same episode of Tales by Light to film anacondas in Brazil and swim along these huge 6-meter, 20-odd foot anacondas in the river was really amazing and sort of just a bit of a dream. So it's hard to pinpoint one. I mean, actually, I should also mention probably one of the most spectacular wildlife locations you could possibly go to, and there's many, but certainly in the top 10 would have to be South Georgia in the Southern Ocean, close to Antarctica. It's just a wildlife mecca. Tens of thousands of king penguins, fur seals, elephant seals, all up on this one beach. And I first went there in 2015 with Peter Eastway and on a ship with about 50 people. And then in November last year, was very fortunate to get invited along with a photographer called David Yarrow from the UK, who's could be another great person for you guys to chat to, actually.
Sure.
David Yarrow is a, you know, an amazing fine art photographer. And we went down with this ship. We had our own small ship, and there was only 7 or 8 of us on board. And we had 5 or 6 days on South Georgia by ourselves, no one else there. So to be on a beach with 250,000 penguins and seals by yourself, it's just like another planet. And that was so special. And we had what made it even more special for me as a filmmaker, we had these very rare drone permits that were granted. So we were able to fly the drone and get, you know, some of the only drone footage probably of South Georgia, particularly a place called St. Andrews Bay. And if anyone wants to Google St. Andrews Bay, South Georgia, you'll see what I mean. It's just an incredible, you know, spectacle of wildlife. So, yeah, that was fairly recently and very, you know, always will live with me. And maybe, who knows, I might not get down there again with such a few people. The planet's getting more and more people are traveling and seeing the world, and certainly Antarctica, I think 50,000 a year, I think was the last number I read. And I think it's growing all the time. More and more people are getting to these places. And maybe, you know, partly I'm to blame with shows like Tales by Light. It's definitely encouraging.
Right. Yeah.
So it's a double-edged sword in a way.
True.
I mean, that sounds exciting, and I mean, I live in the state of Georgia. I haven't seen many penguins, I gotta be honest with you.
Yeah.
Well, I gotta ask you, when you're doing all this planning and setting up for your next journey, how much is it knowing the story you want to tell versus the imagery deciding what the story is going to be?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. We do put a lot of planning into knowing what's in the potential of a place, potential of a story. We rarely do recces where we get to travel there prior to the shoot. Occasionally we will, but usually we are landing and basing it all on research and talking to people before going to a place. I think you've just got to stay very open-minded, because there has been times where the story we thought we wanted to capture hasn't sort of panned out the way we hoped, or there's just been something else that's just come out of the woodwork that is something, you know, more extraordinary that you need to follow. So I think it's just sort of being that sort of, I think that's what's exciting about documentary filmmaking too. I think you need to be, there's always that, it's never certain. And I think you just need to be a curious type of person and ready to sort of adapt to what happens in front of you, because you don't have a defined script when you go in. So it's just a nice balance, but it makes every trip very exciting, and it's sort of the unknowing. I think there's a certain level of enjoyment going back to a place that you know, because you could sort of, whenever you leave, you look back and go, God, we could have done this, we could have done that if we'd only had a bit more time. That's a natural reaction. And returning to a place can be quite satisfying, and getting new things to go, or having new technology to film. Like, for example, South Georgia, returning with a drone was amazing, because back in 2015, I wasn't personally flying drones. Even if I had, I don't think I would have been able to get a permit. So to go back and then be able to capture the same place in a different way is very, very satisfying.
Yeah, you kind of segued again into my next question here. Now we're about the same age, and you've been doing this for quite a while now. First off, we didn't really get to ask you, how did you even get into your first gigs on in nature documentary and whatnot? And I wanted to ask you, how much has technology really boosted what you guys can shoot, how much easier it is to shoot, the different angles you can get? What are the how big of a night and day difference is it from when you started to now?
Sure. Two parts of the question, I guess. How I started, I mentioned before, I just had an incredible childhood, traveling around Australia with my family, and got to meet some incredible people all around the country as my parents wrote history books on Australian history. Oh, so nice. I think my original, interest in history and documentation and the great outdoors definitely all stems from those early years being exposed to it all. I then met a filmmaker called Malcolm Douglas, who really was the original crocodile hunter back from the 1960s. And I grew up watching his films on a Sunday night, him traveling, you know, spending time with the Aboriginals across the Kimberleys. He would, you know, collect crocodiles. He had a crocodile farm. He would do bush cooking and he forward driving. And it was just this real adventurous television, which was amazing. And it just showed the country for what, the beauty of what's out there. And I got to meet him and actually spend time with him. And eventually he did work for him as a cameraman, which was nice. After sending him little home movies and things and sort of pestering him until he sort of took me on as a sort of junior cameraman, sort of straight out of, while I was actually at film school, dropped out of film school and did that. So it's sort of, definitely all of that was a pathway to what we're doing now. In terms of the technology change, it's been incredible. I mean, we were still using fairly small cameras as well as the big shoulder-mounted cameras back in sort of the late 90s, early 2000s. But the advancement of the technology from the cameras, the lenses, obviously drones was a massive revolution, which has just brought a production value to people that was only limited to people who had helicopters. And not only that, the drones get you cameras into places you'd never get a helicopter as well. So that's just opened up a whole new potential. And I've been using drones now since 2013. Before there were sort of those ready-to-fly systems that you can get today. But I think what the beauty of the technology that has continued to evolve is just that you can travel as a small unit, small team, with very compact gear. The brushless gimbals has made things very easy to actually stabilize the cameras. And the show like Tales by Light or Big Cat Tales would have taken a much bigger team to achieve the production values on screen. You could have done that years before, but it just would have taken a hell of a lot more people and a lot more money, a lot more infrastructure. I mean, the Big Cat Diary, which was what Big Cat Tales was based off, had a crew of 40-plus people in the Masai Mara back in the 90s when they were shooting that show. And I mean, we shot with Jonathan Angelo Scott with for Tales by Light with only three of us. We did increase that number to about seven or eight people for Big Cat Tales, but seven or eight crew, couple of editors in the field. It was, you know, a big difference between the sort of 40 that the BBC ran. But it was a different time, you know, different time. And so, yeah, I think the technology shift, which a lot of people have written about, is it's just really democratized the filmmaking process. And it's not limited now to people who have the funding. You can, if you've got a good idea and you've got the passion and you've got the motivation to go out there, the technology is not going to be the thing that holds you back, because you can, it's accessible to everyone.
Right.
I know we're running short on time, but I gotta ask you, with all your passion, all your life dealing with photography and everything like that, is there any time where you've done like a ultra amateur move where like you took a picture and your thumb's in the picture or the lens cap was on, or do you own a selfie stick out of curiosity?
Oh yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we're all human and we all make mistakes. I mean, I remember shooting an interview early, it was a little earlier in my career, with a prominent politician. I worked on a show called School Talk, which was on SBS, which is almost like, it's like a community television, back in the day. And I was on the camera for the interview and we shot this sort of 40-minute interview with this important, fellow. And we got to the end of the interview and I hit stop on the camera and then the red light blinked on. So I wasn't recording the entire thing.
Sweet.
Luckily, I was with a really understanding, you know, mentor that was there, and I had the, you know, courage to actually tell him quietly what had happened. And then he was really good. And he just sort of said, look, we'll just cover a few more questions. And he asked the politician a few more questions at the end and we just rolled those. And he sort of didn't embarrass me. So I never forgot that. He handled it really well. But yeah, I mean, look, you know, we've lost drones. We've had, you know, we things happen. I mean, I always say though, technology, you know, the gear itself is replaceable. It's always the data that's the, you know, biggest worry. And touch wood, we haven't had any catastrophic data loss. But yeah, that's always my that's what keeps me up at night, trying to get the data home safely. And then even when it's home, you got to, you know, put it in multiple locations. So yeah.
So I want to ask you before we go, this is kind of more for our audience, I guess you could say. Now, we do a lot of segments on bears here on the show for whatever reason, just because we're kind of fascinated by bears. And you have had the pleasure of shooting not only polar bears, but grizzly bears and whatnot. What is it like, what is it like to be amongst grizzly bears and shooting grizzly bears? And what are the challenges and what are... What is enjoyable about that?
Yeah, I mean, I've only had one experience with grizzlies in Katmai up in Alaska with Art Wolf. We had about 10 days, which was an incredible experience, flying in on seaplane, landing on lakes, being dropped off, and then basically just guiding ourselves up the rivers while they're feasting on the salmon. And it's so funny, you know, when you start off a trip like that, and I guess I could compare a little bit with a tiger shark, swimming with tiger sharks in the Bahamas, that before you go and before you start, you're asking a lot of questions and there's a lot of sort of, you know, everyone's a bit anxious about how things will work and you've got an idea of, you know, it's a natural thing to sort of be really cautious. And it's funny how at ease and how quickly you sort of you get to things, because before long, you know, within half an hour, we're sort of surrounded by bears because they're, you know, they're all so intent on the fishing. I mean, I remember with a glide cam at the time, sort of a handheld stabilizer, running alongside this bear as it's sprinting up in the shallows trying to catch salmon, and I'm only a couple of meters from it. You know, and, you know, an hour before, I was sort of timidly stepping off the plane. So it's sort of, I mean, you don't want those things to, look, accidents still happen. And that's, I think, when people get too, you know, you don't want to let your guard down too much.
Yeah, I mean, there's a picture on your Instagram where you're standing on the bank of a little river. It looks maybe about 10, 15 feet away from one, just standing in the middle.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. With my wife, I think, at the time. So, you know, she was right in the picture as well. But, yeah, it's amazing. And look, as long as you're in the hands of experts you get guided by them, I think, you know, people can certainly step out of their comfort zone. And the same thing with the tiger sharks jumping in. When we first got to Tiger Beach in the Bahamas with Jim Abernathy, who's an amazing dive operator and shark wrangler, he told me, he said, you know, we're going to get there and you're going to hear things you never would have heard before, and it's going to sound crazy. And he was right. We sort of got there and they were putting out lines and getting ready, and we were inside the boat, and then suddenly the guy comes in. He says, "Mate, there's 8 tiger sharks around the boat. Quick, get suited up. Let's go get the cameras. Let's jump in the water." And it's just such a weird thing to hear. And you come out of the boat, there's just tiger sharks and bull sharks and lemon sharks all around the boat, and then you're getting your wetsuit on and you're climbing in. And it's just, it sort of goes against every instinct that you ever have as a diver or a swimmer or anything. But yeah, there are experiences you never forget.
Abraham, I want to thank you for giving us some time here. I'm a huge fan of Tales by Light. So other than Tales by Light and Big Cat Tales, what are you working on? What can we expect from you? And also, where can people come check out your work or check out what you're up to? What's the best place for them to go?
Sure. Well, we are, you know, Tales by Light, Big Cat Tales continues to be a work in progress. Wish I could say more about that, but I think, you know, watch that space. I mean, the docuseries that hopefully will continue on into the future. We've got several other projects in development, from a documentary feature to other series. A lot of my work when I'm not shooting now is actually, you know, developing series and actually then pitching and that process of, you know, getting it in front of the right eyeballs. So a lot of my time spent with that. Obviously, my Instagram, which is just Abraham Joff, is, I guess, a lot of the updates that come out are through there. And collectively, our website, which is untitledfilmworks.com.au, has a lot more behind the scenes and information about the different series that we're working on. And actually, in a few days' time, maybe by the time this is out, the latest bit of content, which was that trip to South Georgia that I mentioned earlier for David Yarrow, there's a short piece of content coming out from that, which I'll be posting on Instagram shortly. So that for people who are interested in South Georgia, that's a pretty, you know, it'd be a pretty good sneak peek. But yeah, hopefully we'll continue to keep doing this for as long as I can possibly do it.
Awesome, man. So good luck with everything you got going on. And once again, thanks for the time. And it was great hooking up with you.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you guys for the interest.
All right, Mike, Abraham Joff. I feel like if you had that job, you'd be dead by the second shoot.
You just feel like they want a big cat. I'm like, they look kind of cute.
Right, something along those lines. Like, oh, look at that baby bear. Like, let me go pet it. And then the mother comes out and just rips your face apart.
You know, when you're in the middle of the African desert, you can't really get a lot of granches. So I feel the cat would like this.
Oh. You think the cat family would just kind of accept you?
Yeah. You just go over, you treat them like your normal dog, you know. You give them belly slaps. Give them a rest.
Now you're going to belly slap a lion.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, it's all good fun. I mean, I saw the Lion King. As long as you recognize the kingdom, they're all cool with you.
We are learning so much about you today.
Yeah.
This is a very coming out podcast for you. We're learning all sorts of things about you, Mike.
Well, I've been holding back for a while, I've
got to
be honest.
All right, well, let me ask you something. You're, you know, you relate to animals, and you're a pretty big guy. Let me ask if you could take certain things, like how long you think you could last. Okay.
Okay.
All right. So, do you think you could last if all right, could you fight off one baby lion?
Like how much of a baby are we talking about?
Like a month old baby lion.
Month old? I mean, they're I think they're probably in I think they'd be in like the 50 to 100 range. I would say. I think I can. I mean, I remember my vet teching days. I just take one hand, grab them by the scruff, and then hold on to their back legs. I mean, mm-hmm. by rule, I should be able to at least hold on for a little while.
Okay. Could you fight all? How many puppy bulldogs could you fight off? Like angry puppy bulldogs. How many in a life or death scenario could you fight off? When do you think it would become too much for you?
Well, why would they be fighting me? I'm a little confused by this.
Well, like, we're not going into the why. I would fight you for any reason. Maybe you pet them one day.
I'm walking my bunny on the street.
Correct.
And then like 100 bulldog puppies come walking up and they're growling at me.
Yes.
And they're going to attack me.
Right. Like a gang of bulldog puppies. Let's say 3 months old. So right around the time when I got my dog, he was 3 months old.
Okay.
He was about 12 pounds. And they're all angry at you, attacking at your heels and whatnot. How many do you think you could fend off?
I mean, I can't fathom their teeth. They'd be sharp, but they wouldn't be like really penetrating sharp. So I guess I can do like 20 or 30 of them.
So these little cute bulldog puppies are coming after you. What's your strategy? Are you punting each one? Are you trying to make an example?
No, I'd be like, because they don't have a lot of traction. They got small legs. So I can imagine I just keep on like shoving them away to kind of like make an opening to get away from them.
So you're just kind of
like, I got
throwing them aside to get out of there.
Well, like nudging while they're still on the ground. So, you know, it's kind of like if you're on a, with like Obi with a slippery floor, if you just push him, he kind of just scoots away a little bit. It's not a pick you up and fling you. It's a nudge. All right, let me get an opening here. And then I can see after a few, like they'll could be coming back at me from the backside, but I think I can get enough leverage with about 20 or 30, then I can push them aside and then get away from them if I need to.
So we're at around 30 bulldogs. Interesting. What about one chimpanzee? Could you fight off one chimpanzee?
What are your chances? I mean, chimpanzees, man, they got weird, funky strength.
Oh, insane.
They don't play. When they get agitated, they don't play around. That one might be a loss, to be honest.
So you... chimpanzee would get the belt in that fight.
I think so. They got the claws, they got the mouth, they got the strength.
What would be your strategy if a chimpanzee preyed upon you and wanted to start a fight?
That one I could see myself kicking the damn thing and praying I can get it away far enough. Like,
are you going for body shots or are you going straight for the head for like a knockout?
I think body shots. I mean, they got some pretty thick skulls, if I recall, as well. Like for what I do remember somewhere where they, like when they used to experiment with animals, they had to stop using monkeys for stuff for like figuring out falls when they realized like their skulls were thicker than humans, so they couldn't test out things like helmets and stuff. But yeah, it would be like a body shot. Hope I hit a right thing where it loses its breath, or I kick him in the nuts and just sprint like a mofo and pray that it doesn't pick up.
All right. What about how many 80-year-old men could you fend off? 80-year-old men.
Like, these are guys from World War II, so they still got some muscles.
Right. So your average 80-year-old man, you've seen it. Now, yeah, you got the exception, but so you turn the corner, you insulted Guam, and there's, like, a bunch of old 80-year-old Guamites.
But if they're Guamites, I would just destroy them because we already established that earlier today. Right. But let's talk about regular 80-year-olds because that's the real conversation there.
Yeah.
Maybe like 4 or 5.
I was gonna say I think I can seriously mess up 5 80-year-olds, and I would go hard. I'd take their legs out first. You know, you get them on the ground, they're not getting up quick. So if you can get 2 or 3 on the ground immediately, now some of those old codgers, they got they got like stiff jabs, those old like punching bag jabs. Like they can still hit a guy. So I want to avoid their punches.
Their childhood was in like the gyms and stuff like that. So some of them, if you get the wrong 80-year-old, you're going to get messed up.
Right.
But
I feel like some of them still possess that stiff jab. So if they get you, so I feel like a lot of movement would really help against 80-year-old. I think I can get 5 or 6 80-year-olds down on the ground and be okay.
Yeah, if you keep on using speed, trying to get behind them, pushing them down, make them try to use all those achy bones and tendons that they have, then you got a prayer. Like anything more than 5, I think a couple of them can gang up on you and it's over.
Like a really hard low kick to their arthritic hip, I feel like it really put them down for good. Like really hard, solid kick.
I would go for the throat. Okay. I would just punch him in the throat. That seems like a quick go-to to get you some time.
All right. What about how many 10-year-olds could you fend off?
10-year-olds.
10-year-olds. Energetic 10-year-olds. Like, you know, regular 10-year-old kids. Now, I will say that, like, my niece is probably, she's about 9 years old. Pretty strong kid. If she really wants to get on you and kind of, like, you know, we'll rumble around and she'll grab on my leg. She is not easy to get off. How many 10-year-olds do you think you could fend off?
I'm thinking in the same range as 8-year-olds, but maybe a couple more. I'm going to go say 7.
Okay. I feel confident that I can mess up 20 10-year-olds.
That many?
I feel like here's a strategy with kids. Like, if they were coming at you, you got to make an example at the first one. Who's got confidence, right? I mean, I feel like if you power bomb a 10-year-old really, like right away, you say, Scott's not playing games right now. Like, I feel like I can knock her out the first 4 or 5 within the first minute. And then it's about fending off. I feel like a lot of big sweeping leg kicks could really take out a couple of them. Like, man, I don't know. Maybe 20 is a lot. Maybe 12.
That's what I'm thinking.
Maybe 12. They
got the energy,
right?
And when kids, when kids see like adults like horsing around with others, they kind of come together and be like, "All right, let's gang up." Like they all go, "Let's go for one leg" or something like that. They don't just sit back and try to be individual heroes, if you will. Like I can see the 80-year-old just be like, "I was in the Korean War, I'll teach you something," whereas the 10-year-olds are just like, "All right, if 5 of us jump on your leg, we'll get him down."
Yeah, they naturally kind of have like a gang instinct. I kind of see what you're saying there. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna go with 12. I think I could take 12, no problem.
I stick with my number 7. I think when you get into double digits, they're gonna be double teaming body parts and then you're going to be in a mess of trouble.
All right. Well, see. Maybe we can arrange some of these things.
If you have kids at home and want to see us do this challenge, call us at this number.
Yeehaw!
Georgia Childhood Wrestling.
Georgia Childhood Wrestling. GCW. Burlo, what do you got? Anything?
I got one little item here. Now, what is the most awkward thing you ever saw when you were at work?
Most awkward? I'd have to think about that.
Kind of dive into this one, and I'm going to try to keep it as PG as humanly possible here. So I was doing some work and nature was calling, so I went into the bathroom and I opened
by
up
nature
the
was
stall.
Calling you mean that there were 30 bulldogs waiting for you for a fight.
Yeah there were some bulldogs coming out of my body.
Gotcha.
I digress. So I opened up this stall and I'm about to put down paper and do my business, and I look over and I notice there's a bottle of lotion on top of the toilet paper dispenser.
Okay.
And on top of the lotion seems to be a crumbled up piece of the toilet paper.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So, yeah, so I see that and I get out of there and I'm trying to think to myself, like, do I tell somebody this? Like, I'm trying to think, like, do I tell my boss in IT who handles facilities that this has to be handled? Do I go into the HR office and tell the VP of HR? I found two things. I think I have a conclusion on what happened, but I don't want to really tell you in HR.
Yeah.
So I just ended up saying to myself, you know what? I give up. I'm not going to tell anybody. And I figured the cleaning people are going to handle it. So I'm back in the next day, and I decided, well, let me check the stall.
Yeah, see that's what you got to do, a little recon. That's what I would do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They took care of the crumbled up piece of toilet paper, but they left the lotion in the stall.
Hmm. See, I got a story similar to that. Well, not similar, but in the same vein. I would start to think of a recon strategy. How can I nail the person who's doing it? So what you got to do, okay? First, I would do something simple like maybe move the lotion to the other side of the stall and go in notice when someone's going in the bathroom and then peek, did it get moved over to its normal spot? Did it get moved? Move the thing around and see, okay, well, Jim went in and the thing wasn't touched. I mean, it's going to involve a lot of bathroom trips for you. Not going to lie. But.
Yeah, I got to be honest. Of all the duties of work, I don't think my favorite job is to keep track of who's doing stuff in the men's bathroom.
Well, you know what, bro?
I got to be honest.
Things are more important than your stupid work. Like the podcast is more important. You know, a mystery is way more important than whenever you actually have to do at work. It's more about solving the mystery.
Well, how about this? Here's my strategy for figuring out what happened.
Okay.
Instead of touching the lotion, I get a magic marker and I mark right where the lotion is at. And then every time somebody comes out of the bathroom, I go in and see if the lotion is below the line.
Okay.
And that way I would figure out the answer to it.
Not bad, not bad. But could be deceiving. Could be deceiving because, you know, lotion is like a thick substance. So it could be a couple times before it actually is below the line. Not only that, think about lotion in general. Like when you go to squeeze lotion out, right, it goes up the bottle. So sometimes when you turn that bottle back down, it's going to take time to come down to the main part of the lotion population.
Maybe I water it down so I know I have a better idea after the first use. If you pour water in there, then you got not the liquid lotion kind of mixture, and that will come out immediately. Now, granted, you'll get like that mustard water where somebody be in the stall and be like, ew.
Now here's the thing, though. You start watering it down, the culprit might notice that immediately. And they might throw them off, and they might, you know, you might not find out. You need a test subject that's going to use the normal lotion. You got to figure out a way to catch them. I think you just got to sit in the bathroom all day with a GoPro. That's what I think needs to happen.
Well, I don't have a GoPro yet. I mean, I guess once I get one off of Amazon, we can talk about this. But for the moment, I just want a magic marker lotion bottles.
Yeah. So, I mean, you were asking me, the one story that reminds me similar to this, this was a few years ago at a place I used to work. So there was only one bathroom for both males and females, just one bathroom in general for the staff. And one day, we go, and I go into the bathroom, and it is... The toilet is completely full with what I can only describe to you as the largest, thickest poop, if you will. Huge. With what girth was extreme. Okay. So much so that I had to call other people in on it. like, hey, dude, you got to go see what's in there. Okay. So I go to one guy and say, dude, you got to go check this out. He goes, come on. I'm like, dude, you have to see it. Now, bro, like, I'm holding a beer can right now. I'm talking the girth of this beer can.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Like, length I can see. Girth like that, that's some talent there. And to keep it in a piece.
The girth was the more impressive part than the length. It was the girth. Mm. Never seen anything like it. So they go in and they start laughing. We start laughing. We're like, so the word starts traveling through work and people are checking it out. So we go to this one woman, like, hey, you got to go check this out. And she seems a little bit too, like, a little too eager to go check it out. And we're like, you know. And she goes, checks it out, plays, ew, oh, my God, who did that? Blah, 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 blah. I knew something was up. I knew something was up. That was her tell. Many women there did not want any part of it. Like, ah, you guys are gross, you know. All the guys are like, you got to go see this thing, you know. Like, she went way too easily and was like, ew, ew, kind of a weird look on her face. Now, Detective Scott, okay, there happened to be a out of order sign on the door. It was a handwritten post-it that said out of order. So what I did, I took a picture of the post-it with my phone. Okay. And this person had very distinct O's. Okay. They had an O with a, like, a little loopy thing at the top. Very distinct O. And out of order has two O's in it. It has three O's in it. Okay. So those O's. So,
good analysis.
Yeah. So what I did over the next day or two was go and check by people's desks at their post-its. Sure enough, this woman had matching O's.
Dun, dun, dun.
Now, the only alibi she could possibly have is that she had just wrote it down when she went in. But we brought her in on it, and she acted like she'd never seen it before, meaning she was the pooper.
Now, the lady's size, did it match the girth of what was in that toilet?
I don't know how you could judge that, but yeah, I mean, she's a bit of a thicker lady, if you will. Could produce such a thing, but I'm honestly, I don't know what body size could produce this girth. I've never seen girth like this before.
And you've been comparing since, and it's still the number one answer.
Put it this way. I analyze mine every single time and never have come close to that girth. And I consider myself a hit for higher average than most. Let's say that.
You can fill a bowl if you want to.
Exactly.
If you went, came back from a chili cook-off, you'd be like, let me show you something.
Right. So that was one time. And then one time I did get peed on by a woman at work. I know that sounds exotic, but it's not. And actually, it was kind of panicky because the woman was having like a stroke of some sort. And I got called in to come help. And as I went to pick the woman up to help lay her down onto some pillows, she peed all over my shoe.
Ah.
Yeah.
Did she at least buy you a new shoe afterwards?
No, I don't think she had any memory of peeing on my shoe. So I just wore that pee shoe like every day for that. I think I still have the pee shoe, to be honest. Not going to lie.
I would totally be in the hospital. Like, I'm so glad you're doing good. Like, I had to go to Payless to get a new pair of sneakers, but you know, as long as you're doing good right now.
I mean, I had to go and sacrifice my shoe, but you know, as long as you're not dead and all, that's fine.
I had to go into work with my soccer cleats, and like every time I went to the chalkboard, the kids were like, "What's that clanking sound?" And I had to pretend like I didn't know what it was.
Yeah. So that was fun. But Berlo, I guess it's that time of the day. I think it's time to put a bow on this episode. We learned a lot today. We learned about
we put a Bo Duke on it earlier.
We learned that you know a lot about Guam. We learned that we learned a lot about some poop stories. We learned about some weird coworkers you have, and we learned that my mom loves to murder rabbits.
And my dad loves to give me gifts, even though I'm a 42-year-old man.
Right, right. So all is well in verbal shenanigans land. Berlo, anything to promote before we get on out of here?
Yeah, I am going to promote KimBoyko.com. Our friend Kim, who is married to one of our best listeners in Dom Bagnato. She is a talented singer-songwriter.
You said that wrong. She's married to our one listener.
Yeah, but he's still one of our better ones.
By proxy, he's the best and the worst.
True.
Right.
True, true. And former guests as well. Both of them.
Correct.
But, I mean, check out her website, KimBoyko.com. She is an incredible singer and songwriter, plays guitar. She sometimes tours with as Kim and Dave at some places. Her schedule's kind of open now for some reason. I'm guessing something about giving birth and everything this past weekend. But, you know, at least check out the music that she has out there right now and then complain to her why she's not out there touring because it's so beautiful. So go to Kim Boyko. .com. Congrats, Kim and Dom, by the way.
Yes, yes, Kim and Dom. Way to go. Way to go.
And I guess as a side note, when this comes out, congrats on that whole marriage thing, Scott.
Oh, thanks, pal. Thanks, pal. We'll see if we'll see if we'll get there. I mean, we got a couple days. I could still run.
Let's do a cheer for you. There you go. There you go. If you could put that in your vows, since it hasn't happened yet, I appreciate that. And mention Trivia Revolution as well.
Wow. I don't know what to say to that, but I guess I will quickly promote the Verbal Shenanigans comedy show coming back to Tap House 15, as always, this month. April was great, so that brings us to May 30th, where headliner Sean Morton, he's been there a couple times, he's hilarious. With Kate Nichols, Janet Regensburg, Mark Kay, and myself. It is free to make reservations, but I will give you... We are sold out before we even put out flyers for last month. So if you're hearing this and you want to go, it is absolutely free. All it is a two-item minimum. Call Tap House 15 in Jefferson. Make your reservations today. Come on out for a great comedy show and all that jazz. Berlo, I guess it's that time where we can tell them where you can hear us. If you guys, obviously you're listening now on some kind of podcast platform, or you clicked on us or whatnot, or you listened to our Porter McKnight episode, which was freaking awesome last week, you could check us out on all podcast platforms, but you could also find us on internet radio if you're into that kind of thing. Also another podcast network. So the BS Podcast Network, we're happy to be with them. And we are there's a lot of other great podcasts on the network. We are on comingrightup.org on Wednesdays in the middle of the day. We are on Discovery County Network on their line. And Berlo, this is always your job. We are in Pittsburgh at
WHBJ-DB.
WHBJ-DB. That's correct. So that is a Pittsburgh internet radio company. Go check out our Twitter. We've retweeted a bunch of their stuff. And go support them because they're trying to do fun things. And there's also a lot of other programming that is not involve us making up history or talking about Guam and other things and playing with toy cars. Yeah. So
Scott, I feel our niche is to talk about Guam history. I feel that's what's going to push us to
life is funny, guys. Laugh at it and keep doing it. You're back. Bye-bye. Tune in next week. Adios. See ya. Later. Ciao. Bye-bye. Adios. Bye. See ya. Bye.